Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is former House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson, who joins us to discuss the Black Sea grain trade deal and the upcoming midterm elections. But first, here's this week's headlines. USDA is distributing more than $223 million to give producers more local options when it's time to process their animals. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says beef, pork, and mixed processing capacity are expected to increase by about 500,000 head per year, and poultry processing could increase by 34 million birds per year. All told, the projects are estimated to create about 1,100 long-term jobs, not including the construction jobs required to build or expand funded facilities. A measurement of producer sentiment is down for the second straight month. More than 40% of producers surveyed for the Ag Economy Barometer from Purdue University and the CME Group said their top concern for their farm's financial future performance is high input costs for the next year. 21% said rising interest rates, and 13% said lower commodity prices. The numbers are in line with the state of mind in farm country in late 2015 and early 2016, when farm income was about 40% lower than today's figures when adjusted for inflation. And finally, the Russian government says it will continue to allow grain to be shipped out of the Black Sea, but the situation remains volatile. Russia abruptly announced it was suspending its participation in the Black Sea Grain Initiative late last week after claiming its ships were attacked near the corridor used by commercial ships to transport grain. The deal was originally signed in July and has since allowed for greater movement of key goods out of the region. Ukraine has exported nearly 10 million metric tons of corn, wheat, vegetable oil, and other ag commodities since signing the deal. According to data from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, prices of global food staples have dropped in every month of the deal's existence. Colin Peterson was an active observer of agricultural trade during his 30 years in Congress. He says turmoil like the last week for the Black Sea is not conducive to reliable world trade.
Well, you saw what happened, when the thing got suspended. The prices went up significantly here in the United States. And then when it got extended, then the prices went down, I think my producers up here are looking at this like, this is not a bad deal for us. It's probably not good for the people in Africa and so forth. I don't hear much talk about it from my farmers.
So as though that market volatility that you pointed out, obviously big swings in the markets as we and really everyone else in the world is trying to figure out what exactly was going to be Russia's approach here. What is the role of the United States in this issue? We know Turkey and the UN are actively negotiating, but is there something on the geopolitical scale for the U.S. to do? Is there something to do for producers? What do you think?
Well, we're tied in with NATO, and so that, in terms of the war that's going on over there, so I think to some extent we're limited. We've been involved, since I understand it, negotiating kind of on the sidelines to try to make all this stuff happen. But I wouldn't trust the Russians as far as I could throw them, so we're kind of at their mercy, at this point, whatever they want to do. And I think there's a lot of pressure on them from people because of the effect this is having, and folks that depend on, wheat and corn from that part of the world, for their sustenance. So I don't know. I think we're doing what we can. But this is the whole problem when you put all of your, when you have a situation where you're depending on other countries, whatever you're doing, whether it's even really, frankly, for foreign markets, you are to some extent putting yourself in a situation where you can't control it. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, these guys in this foreign grain market are going to, they're going to buy where they are going to get the best price. They're going to factor in the longevity, or in other words, the ability to continue to get grain. But at the end of the day, most of those folks are looking for the best price. So I don't know. I think we're just going to have to ride out this volatility here in the country. I don't think there's anything that Congress is going to do at this point because of it. It might factor into the, you know, into discussion about whether we should have some kind of a permanent disaster program or permanent support program or whatever, but that's not going to come until after the election.
Well, and I want to discuss the election with you, but just quickly before we pivot to that topic, what do you think is the role of the Biden administration here in terms of using this potentially as an opportunity to pursue trade deals in other parts of the world to kind of counter this growing global economic influence that we're seeing from not only Russia, but also China?
Yeah, well, it might be an opportunity there, but one of the problems is, we have got new people in these positions. Some of them are not confirmed. I don't know exactly what they're doing, but, I think all of the effort right now is just focused on doing what we can to try to untangle the current situation, from what I can tell.
We'll be right back to discuss the upcoming midterm elections with Minnesota Democrat Colin Peterson right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. There's no mistaking Democrats have struggled to hold on to seats in rural parts of the country. Former House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson held on to one such district for 30 years during his tenure in Congress, and he says it's going to be a struggle for the current Democratic Party to regain its footing in rural America.
You know, the party is not the party that I was part of when I came to Congress. Hubert Humphrey would just be appalled if he saw the state of the Democratic Party today. But it's a combination of things. I mean, we became more and more urban, and those urban influences, were the majority in our caucus, and they led the caucus in the wrong direction for rural America. And that was part of why I lost. I could withstand Pelosi, tying me to Pelosi, because I had figured out how to work with her. She was supportive of agriculture and whatever I did. That was okay. But then when they, the election, when they tied me to her, Ilhan Omar and AOC, that was too much. And people saying, what are you doing in a party with those people? So that's part of the problem. We got folks in our party that just do not go over in this part of the world. You've got the gun issue, the abortion issue that affect the rural situation. But I think this is the biggest problem politically we have in agriculture, that we don't have any farm Democrats left. Mm-hmm. And you cannot do farm policy and you can't do a farm bill with one party because it's not going to stick. And I don't know what you do about it, but it's a huge problem. And, we're maybe heading to another situation like we've had the last couple times where food stamps and nutrition become the dividing line. If the Republicans take over both the House and the Senate, which they might do, they'll probably end up doing something in nutrition that the Democrats don't support. And if that happens, Biden will veto it, and there's not enough votes to override the veto. And so I think it's a huge problem. And I don't really know what you do to fix it. The Republicans have been smarter. They've put a lot of effort into redistricting. in that whole process. And so they have gerrymandered these districts. To some extent, that's why we don't have any Democrats left. But it's just the party, what the party supports is more of an urban agenda. And that does not go over in these rural districts.
Well, in some of these rural districts, obviously, you're going to have a lot of voters that are actively engaged in production agriculture, a lot of folks from kind of the small town America side of things. I wonder, are those folks there for the Democratic Party to get? Obviously, it might take a messaging change, as you mentioned. Are those folks there for the Democratic Party to get, or is that part of the world just too solidly Republican now?
Well, at this point, I think it's too solidly Republican. And I'm not sure that our party is willing to move on some of these issues in order to try to win those back. So I don't think this is something you can message your way out of. You know, the party itself has got to change some of the things it is doing. And, you know, and the Republicans have been smart to capitalize on some of the stuff that's being said by some of these urban liberals in our party that have given them red meat to go after us on all kinds of different things, whether it be abortion, guns, but transgender bathrooms and CRT and schools and all that sort of stuff. The so-called woke part of the Democratic Party. And so if you've got people like that shooting off their mouth, it makes it very difficult for anybody to survive. I mean, the only Democrats we have left that have any farm district is Angie Craig and Cindy Axney. You got Sanford Bishop down in Georgia. But most of the folks that have some production agriculture are surviving because three-fourths of their district is urban, you know, a suburban and so forth. So that's how Craig and Axney survive. Sanford, you know, he's got a rural district, a little different. He has a large black population, but, you know, I just sent him some money because he's apparently concerned about him surviving. So, you know, the party's got to change. And, you know, in Minnesota, we're probably a good example of this. The legislature now, when I first was elected, I had 34 legislative districts, Senate and House, in my congressional district. 31 of them were Democrat, 3 were Republican. This was in 1991. Today, as of the last election, there were 3 Democrats and 31 Republicans. And it looks like after this election, there won't be anybody, maybe one Democrat left in my whole, my old congressional district, and that's the city of Moorhead, which has turned very Republican the last few years. So I don't know. I don't know what you do about that. I mean, it's right. Very hard to overcome.
Well, and you touched on some of the Farm Bill implications of this, but there is precedent for getting a Farm Bill done when the president is of a different party than either one or both of the majority parties in the House or Senate. But what do you think would be the Farm Bill implications? You know, if we accept the prognostication that Republicans will take the House, let's, you know, for the sake of argument, say they take the Senate too. They're still going to have to work with a Democratic president to pass a Farm Bill. What do you think will be the implications there?
Well, I think I said it earlier. I think the stumbling block is nutrition. And the way I was able to maneuver this within the Democratic Party was that I worked with Rosa DeLauro and Nancy Pelosi and you know, my colleague from Massachusetts. Anyway, I worked with them. We came up with a nutrition package that they could support. And once that happened, then I pretty much had free rein to work on the rest of the farm bill, the Title I, crop insurance, conservation, rural development, and so forth. I don't see that going on right now. And I think I've been preaching to people that if the Republicans take over, they need to go over and figure out from the Senate and House Democrats what it is they can live with on food stamps or what it is they want. Pat Roberts was smart enough in the last farm bill to understand that. He made a deal with Debbie Stabenow before we even started that food stamps were off the table. And Conaway did not take part in that, and that caused a divide in the House. At the end of the day, Conaway had to give in, and they ended up where they would have been in the first place. So I just think they just keep chasing this, it's not going to happen. And if they don't understand, if they don't listen, there will not be a farm bill, at least until 2025, and then, you know, it'll depend on who gets elected at that point.
Well, and election's certainly coming up this upcoming Tuesday. We will know a lot more about the upcoming farm bill process once votes are cast in that upcoming midterm election. But for now, we'll have to go with the information we've got. And at this point, we appreciate what you've shared with us here. Former House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoyed it.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at the House races on our radar in the upcoming midterm elections.
Democrats have been in control of the House since reclaiming the majority in the 2018 midterm elections. But on Tuesday, voters across the country could tip the balance of power back to the GOP. This chart shows the current makeup on the House of Representatives. Democrats hold a 220 over 212 majority, and three vacancies will be filled in the upcoming elections. It's important to note that in the 2018 midterms, Democrats were able to pick up seats in many districts with rural and suburban voters. Republicans have an opportunity to flip seats in their favor this time to try and regain control. Races for all 435 seats will be important, but we're going to be paying special attention to seven toss-up races with implications for ag policy. Five of those races involve Democratic members of the House Ag Committee. In Connecticut, Democrat Johanna Hayes is facing Republican George Logan. Virginia Democrat Abigail Spanberger is going up against Republican Yesley Vega. New York Democrat Sean Patrick Maloney is currently representing the 18th district, but he's running in the 17th district because both districts were remapped. He's facing Republican Michael Lawler. Minnesota Democrat Angie Craig is facing Republican Tyler Kistner. Finally, Washington Democrat Kim Schreier is facing Republican Matt Larkin. We're also paying attention to two races with Republican incumbents. California Republican David Valadao is on the House Ag Appropriations Committee. He's currently neck and neck with Democratic challenger Rudy Salas. Meanwhile, Nebraska Republican Don Bacon, who's on the House Ag Committee, is in a close race with Democratic challenger Tony Vargas. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're excited to be joined by this week's panel to continue our discussion on the Black Sea Grain Initiative and some of the developments that we've seen on that over the course of the last week. Joined this week by Kip Tom with Tom Farms and Vince Peterson with the U.S. Wheat Associates. Appreciate both of you taking the time. And Kip, I want to go to you first because we've seen a bit of a will they or won't they with Russia in regards to this grain deal. How do you assess sort of the strength of that deal right now, given all of the uncertainty that we've seen from Russia?
Well, I just returned from Ukraine just about a week and a half ago, and I can tell you there is a lot of uncertainty with the deal. We don't know, you know, for sure how the behaviors of Vladimir Putin is going to behave under different scenarios, and I think they're very easy for them to find reasons to discontinue the deal, as we saw this last weekend, on again, off again. And so it's I'm just glad we've resumed trade and we're moving it back out in the Black Sea.
So, I mean, yes, trade has resumed, but there was still plenty of, you know, political and military uncertainty. At a certain point, does it become a little bit untenable for private sector companies to be considering this particular route?
They seem to be pretty aggressive in there. They've moved out about a little over 7 million metric tons to date since the initiative was started. We know that there's been a backup down in Turkey with nearly 100 and some ships waiting to be inspected before they can go on out into the world markets. But, you know, in my travels there this past 2 weeks, I can say this, that we're seeing a lot of movement of grain from the interior markets to the ports to move on out into that global marketplace. But they got a long way to go. You know, they probably still have well over 20 million metric tons of last year's crop to move before they can even harvest much more of this year's crop and put it into storage for movement later this winter or into next summer.
Well, and Vince, as we've discussed here already, a ton of uncertainty, a ton of changes just within the last week on the scope of this deal. But I wonder, as someone, you know, U.S. Wheat obviously pays such close attention to global wheat markets, not just that of the United States, wondering how has the last week of uncertainty impacted those global wheat markets?
Well, you know, I think we put the burden of this whole thing on squarely on Putin's shoulders. Frankly, if we didn't have a war in Ukraine, we didn't have a blockade of the port of Odessa in the first place and the attack of merchant marine shipping fostering all this stuff, we wouldn't be talking about this stuff. So I think it's important to remember where the blame for this comes. But in terms of effect on the world trade, we're getting, of course, price volatility. Every time Putin decides he's in or he's out or he's in or he's out, we're getting corresponding spikes and troughs in the wheat market as we try to figure out what direction we're going with that. But I'd happen to agree with Tom on the assessment that when the smoke clears, commodities have been moving out of there, and you try to assess a little bit what hole is left in the marketplace by the war over there. And frankly, in my opinion on this, it's not really a very big hole in the wheat market as long as we keep moving at the pace we're doing. Last year, Russia and Ukraine, I think, exported about 52 million tons of wheat. That's milling wheat and feed wheat together from the two places. And even this year, with the war going on, we're anticipating even more wheat coming out of the Black Sea than last year. And that's with about half of the volume of Ukraine, but much more wheat potentially coming out of Russia, unless the whole thing collapses completely. But they've got a huge crop. So in the end, I think we're in a pretty good balance, but we just have the uncertainty overweighing everything.
Well, and if we, I know it's really hard to ask you to do something like this, but if we take the Black Sea issues kind of out of the equation and look at the rest of the world wheat market, what are things looking like around the world elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, actually, we started the year with kind of a little bit of a tight situation where we're consuming more wheat in the world than we're producing right off the bat this year. But since things have progressed, we have a record crop in Russia that's overlooming. They had a big crop last year and a big one this year. So there's a lot of wheat backed up, and it's going to be backed up over there. But then we've had some recent things turning against us, just the world, just a little bit since that time. You have this La Nina effect, which is real and which is true, and it's affecting the wheat production in Australia. They're looking to have a not quite but near record crop, but about a quarter of that crop right now, maybe 8 million tons, is going to be downgraded because of the torrential rains in the eastern part of Australia. Conversely, in Argentina, a torrential drought has been affecting the country. They're cutting exports back. They're probably going to be down 5 or 6 million tons in total wheat exports out of Argentina this year. So you got kind of things going two different directions. So the things that we look at, we compete with Argentina in our hemisphere. We compete with Australia in the Pacific. Our environment, our market environment, what we're logistically close to, is actually in a different circumstance, perhaps than maybe Africa, South Asia, and some others that are more tributary to Russia.
We'll be right back to continue our discussion on the war in Ukraine and the global wheat markets right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. As the global wheat trade seeks to react to whether or not Russia will in fact remain in the Black Sea Grain Initiative, Vince Peterson with the U.S. Wheat Associates says U.S. producers are facing multifaceted impacts.
Yeah, I think it's given us a couple of things. One, it has admittedly given us a higher price structure in the whole thing, whether that's energy focused, war focused, input focused, all of those kind of things are leading to higher prices. Some this year are doing quite well under that structure. We've had some good areas, some good yields, but then you take the big hard red winter wheat area, which was stricken by drought and the yields were very modest. When you put the high prices of fertilizers and inputs on top of a low yield, yeah, that's a pretty big stress for a lot of those producers. So it's a little bit of a mixed message on if we're coming out better or worse on this thing. But I think prices are such it probably is a little bit of an incentive to increase some wheat production a little bit this year.
Well, and on that front, I know obviously winter wheat is so incredibly important to American wheat production. Do you think the current picture around the world is going to have any measure of impact on spring wheat acres in the U.S.?
Oh, I can't imagine that it won't. We've got a little bit of time to think about that before we get to next March or April. I wouldn't begin to guess which way that's going to go. I think it's going to depend on competitive prices of soybeans, oil seeds, corn, all of those things, sugar beets, all of those things that impact spring wheat producers' planting matrix when they come to that time period. I think I'd defer a little bit on that question.
Well, and obviously when we look at the Black Sea Grain Initiative, global wheat production, obviously you can't separate this issue from the hunger issue around the world. And Kip, you and I have spoken about this issue before, and we look at figures from the UN, from the Food and Agriculture Organization. We see some trending downward as folks are looking to, better understand that grain initiative. Have things trended downward enough to make any kind of a significant dent in global hunger?
Well, unfortunately, no. We haven't made the strides we need to there. We know that it's not only just access to the physical commodities itself, it's access to the capital to buy those physical commodities. But if I could go back for a little bit here and address the wheat production issues, we look into Ukraine, and I met with a number of the large associations when I was there, and typically they seed somewhere around 7 to 7.5 million hectares of winter wheat. I know some of the report numbers that came out of USDA and WASDA and others here recently indicated they planted nearly 3.5 to 4 million hectares of winter wheat. The people we were talking to said they seeded about 2.5 million hectares. So they've got that issue going on. They have lack of capital to buy the fertilizer to fertilize that wheat. They don't have access to fertilizer at this point in time for this coming winter season to apply the nitrogen to the wheat crops. So we've got a lot of issues in front of us about the physical commodity itself and the money to buy that product to go out there and make those the impact on global hunger.
Kip, I know in some of your previous travels over there, you've spoken with folks that have had issues getting access to diesel. Obviously, diesel, a very important fuel from a military operational standpoint. What is that looking like for the Ukrainian producer? What will they have the supplies available to do what they need?
It's very difficult. You know, we talked to a number of the top 10 producers in the country, and a lot of them are having issues with access to electricity. We know that Putin's been very strategic in his bombing of infrastructure throughout the country. So a lot of them are running very large grain facilities with generators at a minimum capacity. We know that the farmers don't have money to dry grain, so they're bringing in grain in, letting it stay in the field as long as they can. One producer we met had nearly 250,000 acres of corn to harvest and hasn't harvested a single acre yet, because he can't access the diesel fuel to put in the combines, to run the trucks, to get the crop in the storage, and let alone his storage is almost full. And, that's why they're watching the Black Sea Initiative to see if it goes forward or not, because they're in a position they can't move the product out of their bins. They don't have room for harvest. So they're in a very difficult situation, not only in fuel, but fertilizer, crop care products. Most importantly, capital is the biggest issue.
What role do you think fertilizer is playing here in sort of the health of this Black Sea Grain Initiative? Because I have to imagine Russia is very interested in getting its fertilizer to global markets, and this deal is a big part of that, Kip.
I couldn't agree more. I've spoken to Amir Mohammed, who's representing the UN on the Black Sea Initiative, and it is an important component of this whole trade deal as Russia continue to see their fertilizer flow into the global markets, and not at the discount that was earlier. They want to see it get world prices for it. I really struggle with that because I know very well that the money we're spending on nitrogen in the United States and other places is doing nothing but funding Putin's war against the Ukrainians. So it's a very difficult situation.
So a lot of developments that we've seen over the course of the past week with this Black Sea Grain Initiative. I can't imagine that we've seen the end of developments on that in the near term or certainly in the long term as we look to see what is the future of that deal currently set to expire on the 19th of November. But Kip and Vince, we appreciate the time.
We're glad to be with you, Spencer.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at the Senate races we'll be watching in Tuesday's midterm elections.
Republicans are seeking to gain a majority in the Senate in the midterm elections. And the current 50-50 Senate means only one seat needs to flip their way for that to happen. But a good night for Democrats could grow the narrow majority they have when Kamala Harris casts a tie-breaking vote. This map shows the Senate races taking place in 2022, when one-third of the chamber is up for re-election. You can see many incumbents are expected to hold onto their seats, but we're going to be paying attention to four races: Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Iowa. The race in Georgia is one of the most hotly contested seats in this election. Incumbent Democratic Senate Ag Committee member Raphael Warnock is facing off against Republican challenger Herschel Walker. The race is a toss-up and may end up going to a runoff. Another race in the national spotlight is in Pennsylvania, where Democrat John Fetterman is running against Republican Mehmet Oz. Fetterman had a healthy lead in polls earlier this year, but this race is now considered a toss-up. In Iowa, Republican incumbent Chuck Grassley is facing off against Democratic challenger Mike Franken. Grassley is seeking his eighth consecutive term, and polls give him a slight advantage. In Wisconsin, incumbent Republican Ron Johnson is facing off against Democrat Mandela Barnes. Right now, most polls give Johnson the advantage. Colorado, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Nevada, and Ohio could offer other close races to watch on election night. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. Tuesday's elections will, of course, be the big story of the week. We'll have coverage of what we know in Wednesday's newsletter, and check back with us Wednesday afternoon for a webinar on the results. USDA will release selected tables, including 10-year projections for major U.S. crops and livestock products. And finally, the latest version of the Consumer Price Index will be rolled out on Thursday. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.